let's turn our attention now to God's Word tonight. Turn to 1 Samuel chapter 27, learning about David, the life of David, the different things he is experiencing and responding and showing his heart. As we know, the Scriptures describe him as a man after God's own heart, tells us that way, and we're able to at least decipher and draw out what we see in David, where it does represent that for the most part, yet he is a man, and there's certainly other areas and issues in his life with sin or weaknesses that we see in his life, and yet the general description is that he is a man who leans on the Lord, and that's what I wanted to talk about tonight, at least bring to your attention from this text here as we come to the final years of David in his wilderness wandering. He is not able to stay in one place. He's not able to establish himself in a village unaccosted by Saul and his armies or Saul's spies or anybody who may be more favorable to Saul than David. He has to move about, and that's what marks this time. And at this particular time frame, towards the end of those years that he's doing that, it's marked by an exile where he has to leave the borders, beyond the borders of Israel or Saul's jurisdiction or Saul's control, and get outside of that for the reasons that are going to be revealed here throughout these chapters. Now, there's a number of chapters here, chapter 27 through 31, and we'll divide them up into two, but they're kind of intermixed because it's happening simultaneously. One part is what David is doing, the other part is what Saul is doing. And this would be the time frame in which Saul will meet his end in the battlefield against the Philistines. At the same time, we find David doing things and acting in what we've seen before in his warlord ways, where he's raiding those who would be enemies of Israel, where he's housing himself or concealing himself in places out of Saul's reach. And he's providing for this large group of people that are with him, 600 soldiers, their families, his wives, and of course their possessions. They're having to find a way to live in the land where they don't really find a welcome mat. And so that's the time frame that we're talking about, and you got to understand the context of that is in David's heart and David's mind. So in chapter 27 is... we're going to see David, and then chapter 28 will be Saul. So we'll skip over chapter 28. That's Saul going to the medium at Endor. Chapter 29, back to David, where he is interacting now with a king of the Philistines. Chapter 30 is David again, but chapter 31, jumping back over to Saul, we find Saul fighting and dying in the wilderness. So that's where this fits into. And we're going to just deal with David tonight. This is to keep him, really, a decision to go into exile is to keep him out of the reach of Saul. He, up to this point, has been hiding in the forests and in the wilderness, in the deserts, in the canyons, in caves. But over time, eventually, this is going to wear out. Eventually, he's not going to be able to hide anymore because people will know him and people will see what's going on, and Saul's going to be coming and going and searching him out. Eventually, someone's going to turn him in like the Ziphites were trying to do, and eventually, I believe he's in his mind thinking, the day's going to come where I'm not going to be able to elude his grasp, and so he's going to have to make some decisions, and that's what the exile years or whatever the time frame is, months, is here, we find at the end of this. And that's what this text is in chapter 27. Let me begin by reading that, because we remember the last time Saul and David met face to face at the hill of Hakilah. This is in the south in the land of Judah. And he meets him there in the middle of the night as the Lord puts a sleep on Saul and his soldiers and those who would protect him, allowing David to enter in and go in with his sidekick here, Abishai, and they're able to stand over Saul in his sleep and take a spear and take his canteen, his, you know, what is it, the 10th century BC canteen, a jug of water. And to prove that he was there, he could have killed Saul again, But he refuses to do that. He will not lay his hand upon the anointed of God. God had anointed King Saul. It is God's hand that will take Saul, take his life or spare it, not David. And so this is another scene which he does this. But this is the last time he will see Saul. And it's at that point in which he's saying, "Why are you chasing me? Why are you coming after me? I'm not a threat to you. Again, I prove myself I'm not a threat to you. I have your spear that was stuck in the ground by your head, and I didn't put it in your heart. Instead, I have it in my hand here to show that I'm not interested in threatening you and putting you to death." And Saul tells him that I am the one who's wrong, not you, David. Everything is fine between me and you now. Come home. And David refuses to come home. Instead, he goes one way. Saul returns to his place. And we find not too long after that, chapter 27 says this, "Then David said in his heart, 'Now I shall perish one day by the hand of Saul.'" I shall perish. Time's running out on me. I can't keep running and keep hiding. Something's going to give eventually. "There is nothing better," he says, "for me than that I should escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul will despair of seeking me any longer within the borders of Israel, and I shall escape out of his hand." And so here is David resolving at this point. He needs to do some elusive measures, some more extreme measures than he's done before, and get out of Saul's grasp and live amongst his enemies even. This would be a time highlighted by David leaning on the Lord through difficulties and concealment, as he has already. He has leaned on the Lord. He had yet been defeated in battle. He had yet to be captured by Saul, especially the outnumbering army of Saul, and considering the odds of that, yet to face any loss at this point. But now comes this time, and he sees the writing on the wall, it seems. He sees that day may come. And at the end of this, in this part here in chapter 30, we find there is a certain despairing or loss that is finally realized by the people, and they're at the point they're ready to stone David to death. So this is a difficult time, and it's kind of coming to a head for him, a heavy burden upon his shoulders. He feels a bit of an emotional depression at this point, and the pressure now will come to, are you going to continue to lean on the Lord? What does that mean, to lean on the Lord? To lean on him. Well, Proverbs 3, verse 5 and 6 is a text that we always think of when we talk about trust in God and looking around us and seeing the difficulties around us or struggling through whatever it is we struggle through and lacking the understanding of what to do. And the call there by Solomon is to trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. Don't lean on your own understanding in this. But in all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make straight your paths. So leaning here has to do with faith in God, trusting God, even though my understanding says something differently. My understanding may take me in a different way, but I want to lean on him. And that idea of leaning has been used by the prophets, like in Isaiah, where he speaks to reprove the kings of Israel and the leadership of Israel as Assyria is coming down and a threat to the Israelite nation and Judah as well. In this particular case, it's Judah. They are a threat to them. And what do? Who do they lean on? And the accusation here is you're leaning on the staff or the broken reed of Egypt. You want Egypt to come to your rescue. You're going to trust in them. You're going to go to them. You're going to buy their loyalties and buy their army to come to your rescue and fight the Assyrians for you. And the reproof there is you have leaned on the staff of Egypt, which will pierce you through your hand eventually. You should not lean on them. Don't rest or stay upon them, but trust in God. This is what marks David. David is going to make a decision here to go and escape to the Philistines, not to lean on the Philistines. It might appear that way, that I need your help. Achish, who's the king. I need your armies to fight my battles. I want to hide behind you. He's not actually doing that here. What he's doing is he's escaping into and outside of the borders of Israel because that's what he feels in his heart, in his mind. I need to do this because I am vulnerable and I need to move and make a wise decision and move out from the grasp of Saul. It's more on that than it is leaning on the king of Gath or this Philistine king. So we want to be sure we see that. This part of David's exploits, by the way, creates some real questions to many readers as you read through these texts. Certainly David is not a perfect man. Certainly David is not always wise in his choices and his decisions, and maybe there's some questions, some things that he does here or responses or actions that he does. For example, David's fear of Saul here. He's afraid of Saul. He's afraid he's going to be captured by Saul, so he makes a decision based on that, escapes to the Philistines. Is that by faith? Is he doing that out of faith, or is he doing that out of fear? Or David's deception at this time, where he deceives Achish, his real intentions, his real actions here, kind of showing or buying this king's favor, and the king thinking, I could trust this guy, he's no threat to me. And David, in the meantime, is not really revealing his full intentions. So there's some deception, maybe. Some see David's actions of genocide as he raids certain tribes to the south of Judah and wipes them out and slaughters everybody, and someone would question that that's against the Geneva Convention. Or David's willingness to join the Philistines in the attack against Israel, that he's willing to go with this king to fight Saul. Is he really wanting to do that? Is that a good decision or choice? So there's a lot of questions that are surrounding this, but I'm going to back up here and say this is a narrative. This is not a commentary. This is not a didactic section that is teaching us lessons or teaching us theology as much. It's showing us a narrative of the life of David. And so we want to see, how is David responding? Why is he doing this? And is he leaning on God throughout this passage? And I think the best evidence is just that, that he still trusts God. I think the best lesson to take from this narrative is the heart of David trusting in the Lord, making the best decisions he can, walking in the best ways, turning to God when he doesn't know what to do, and God gives him help. I think this is what we see towards the end of this, if we were to wrap this up in one basic lesson. And David seems to be leaning on other things, maybe his own understanding, maybe as he sees that the best thing to do here is get out of the lands of Israel. Maybe he's leaning on his own understanding there, but I think ultimately we find him resting in God and seeking God and asking God for help. So we want to see that in this. So let's wrap up this, what really is a conclusive chapters of his wilderness years, marked by this exile in this land called, or this city called Ziklag. It's to the south. He's raiding. There's a setback at this particular time, whereas he's going to help the king in his battle against Israel, while he takes his soldiers there, it exposes Ziklag, and the Amalekites come and raid and take everything. And it causes a real sorrowful time for his men. And so we see this interesting scene. So I'm just going to take this whole time frame here, about three chapters worth, just walk through a simple outline for you. First of all, the first thing you see, what sets it off, is this emotional depression where he seems to have been at a high point with Saul, and Saul goes away, and it seems like he's now safe from Saul, and so quickly he just falls over or slides down the backside of the mountain into a valley of what seems like a depression. He says, "Now I shall perish one day by the hand of Saul." There's something of this emotion here. There's an experience of despondency, it seems, soon after being filled with the thrill of triumph and courage dealing with Saul not too long before that. And so here he is, and he's experiencing this at this point, and he wants to needs to make a decision regarding his people and those who are around him, that he's bearing their burden of their safety. He must have been feeling pretty confident escaping Saul, but it's very quickly here he is. Now he's afraid of Saul again. Now he's concerned that I'm running out of time. I'm running out of luck, if you can use that word here. I'm running out of safety places or escape routes. What can I do? What are we to do? Saul is going to get us eventually, is his thinking. It's common sense. There's nothing better for me, he says, than that I should escape. I can't think of a better place. I can't think that we're in a good spot. We need to get out of here, out of the land of Israel and into the land of the Philistines. And the Philistines would be bordering Judah, the tribal lands of Judah, to the west, especially towards the coastal lands. And so he's going to move down in that direction, out of the grasp of Saul. And then he says, then Saul will despair in seeking me any longer within the borders of Israel, and I shall escape out of his hand. Now, you wonder, well, I thought Saul was done chasing after David. Maybe David's just fearful of nothing at this point and afraid of what might be. He's paranoid. And you might see that, but then at the end of this text, verse 4, and when it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, he no longer sought him. So he actually still is chasing after David, breaking his own words in the chapter before. And so David is really at a point of despondency here. It may be commonly viewed, by the way, in commentators at this point, that this exile of David was a poor choice. It was a sign of unbelief or a period of sin and spiritual decline in him, that he shouldn't have done this, that he should have just prayed to the Lord and trusted God would protect him. He has protected him up to this point. And he should just stay within the areas he's been and hope for the best in that sense, that God will watch over him. After all, God has promised him the kingdom. God has promised him the throne. Well, again, he's human, like we all are. And we can cling to those promises, but there are days in which it seems like the promise seems a little distant and the struggle is real and the danger is real and the risk is higher now, and that's the case with him now. And you got to think about how many people are with him. 600 soldiers, add to that their wives and children, his wives and his children here. There's a lot of people to hide and to travel. You can't get up, oh no, we need to escape in the night. If you're a band of soldiers, that can happen quickly. You could take off in the middle of the night and be gone and miles away from your enemies before you know it. You can hike the high mountains and get up the rocky crags and get over the other side pretty quick. That can happen. I mean, that happens in Afghanistan all the time with these Taliban soldiers doing their thing. They're always escaping that way. But when you're taking everybody, that's a different story. When you've got many people to deal with and young ones and women and elderly people and whatnot, you got a band here that you got to work together, and the burden of protecting them is on David's shoulders. And so he has to think and be wise with this. He has to think about, in his anxiety, about, I don't want to be exposed to Saul anymore like this. And we are becoming much more exposed to Saul. They're adding, by the way, during this time, they're adding to the numbers of people are coming over from Saul's side to his side. 1 Chronicles 12 indicates that to us in this time frame. He's building up from 600. Now more are coming to his side. And thus it's a large group. And so here he is. And personal concern, I think, for his people will lead him to make this decision here. He's got to. He has the burden here. He's despairing of the safety and the care of his people more than just himself. So let's not just read that text as it's just David afraid for his own life. There's much more involved. And you think about the saints. Think about believers when we face dismal prospects, missionaries, Christian churches in other parts of the world where the threats are real and the dangers are real. And the negative assessments about the matter at hand may be very correct. This is not a good situation. What are we to do? We're despairing if we stay here, despairing of our lives. We should escape. And we need to get out of here. This is dangerous, risky. This is not a safe situation. Should safety be our first concern? And it may be, thinking in that way, like a missionary, it may be foolish and foolishness wrapped in faith to just kind of throw ourselves at risk. There are people involved here. There are lives involved. There is the work here. There are children. There are wives. There are families. And you can't just think in terms of yourself. I'm going to go for it, and if it costs me my life, big deal. I'm willing to lay down my life for the Lord. Well, think of others as well. Think of the situation. There's a lot more to it than that. And David, I think, is thinking beyond himself here. Refusal to flee to safety may not necessarily be an act of faith in that case. It might be just, in a sense, a bold risk that might not be considerate of others and what might be the wisest course. So think through that when we consider these texts and we consider David's acts here. This is not necessarily David acting in sin, and I don't think it is. So, emotional. He's oppressed. He's got to make a decision, burden upon his shoulders. And so he chooses a course, secondly, of self-banishment. He's going to banish himself and his people out of the land of Israel, take them out of there, and move on to the Philistines. Now, remember what he said to Saul in chapter 26, where he told him, your efforts to try to chase me down and hunt me down are pushing me to the edge and pushing me to the extremes so that I'm not allowed to come before the Lord. I'm not allowed to worship. I'm not allowed to be a part of the congregation of Israel. Though he's still within the lands of Israel, he's being pushed out. And here's the results of it. He's even pushed out now out into the pagan lands of the Philistines. Doesn't mean he's going to bow down to those idols. At least it was something to get Saul to think about. Your actions are pushing your fellow brothers out into the lands where all they have are idols and idol lands and idol worshipers. Is that what you want for your people? So he spoke like that to him, and here he is going to the Philistines. Philistines bow down to Baal, Ashtoreth, Dagon, number of gods. That was the gods of those territories. That's how they viewed things. And David has to make a decision, and his decision is to banish himself into those territories, a place he doesn't want to go and be a part. Yet he must do that, and he's going to. Verse 2. So David arose and went over, he and the 600 men who were with him, to Achish, the son of Maok, king of Gath. And David lived with Achish at Gath, he and his men, every man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail of Carmel, Nabal's widow. And when it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, he no longer sought him. Well, he couldn't. That was his enemy. That would mean war to try to go into Gath. He would have to fight the Philistines in order to get to David, and that wouldn't be a wise course. So this is an interesting decision of David to move out in this area, actually put himself now less risk with Saul. Now, what does that mean to be with the Philistines? Will they trust him? Will they then turn on him? Well, that's the risk he's taking here. That's the calculated decision he makes here. Will the Philistines turn on me? Will the Philistines fight me? Can I win this king's trust over? And that's his efforts here. So his banishment is to do that. They're not seeking Achish here, this king, to be their savior. They're not seeking out the Philistines to say, oh, I'm going to go over here and beg the Philistines to protect me. All they did is they moved over in this. And they sought out Achish and lived with Achish. In verse 5, then David said to Achish, if I have found favor in your eyes, let a place be given me in one of the country towns that I may dwell there, for why should your servant dwell in the royal city with you? So for some reason, Achish welcomes him in, probably because he knows that Saul doesn't like David. And so there's a bit of a civil war going on. So he's thinking, hey, I've got an ally with this guy against this King Saul. So we'll welcome him in. We'll see how he is. We'll see if he's trustworthy. And he wins over that trust. And David says, you know, my people, it's not going to do well to be here in the royal city. Give us an outlying city that we can take and live with and protect and serve you in that way. Just send us as far out as far as your influences are, and we'll dwell there. And so he asks for that, and Achish gives him Ziklag. Verse 6. So that day Achish gave him Ziklag. Therefore Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day, and the number of the days that David lived in the country of the Philistines was a year and 4 months. And so he would be there for a good year and 4 months, 16 months, and into this territory of Ziklag. I think I've got a map of that. There's a picture of actually the ruins in southern Israel to this day. That would be the city of Ziklag. And then on the map, it's way down, kind of on the border of the tribal lands of where Judah would be. And it is tied to the deserts and the direction towards Egypt. And there are different tribes of different people that the Israelites, as they're coming through the wilderness, came across with Joshua, and those that would attack the Israelites or be a threat to Israel at that time. So this is where he would be, in this place called Ziklag. So Achish was well pleased with this, and he, sure, you can do that. I'll send you down there. And David moved his men there. In verse 8, now David and his men went up and made raids against the Geshurites, the Gerzites, and the Amalekites. For these were the inhabitants of the land from of old as far as Shur to the land of Egypt. And David would strike the land and would leave neither man nor woman alive, but would take away the sheep, the oxen, the donkeys, and the camels and garments and come back to Achish. And he would come back to Achish because he would bring him the spoils. So you see what David's doing here? So I'll go out here. I'll stay away from your capital city. I don't want to be anything in your hair and underneath your nose. But I'll be out here, and trust me, and I'll take care of this city here and your southern borders. And he would go out and raid and take the spoils and come back and buy Achish's loyalty. And Achish would be, hey, we're getting spoils. This guy's fighting. Now, Achish is thinking he's fighting against Saul's armies and Saul's territories and taking spoil from there. And this would be what we'll call the concealed loyalties. I'll say that. Verse 10. When Achish asked, where have you made a raid today? David doesn't tell him where. He would say, against the Negev of Judah. That's a very general statement. The Negev is basically the desert region, that area down there of Judah, a large section of land. I just raided out there. And Achish would assume, oh, against the Negev of the Jerahmeelites, he said, or against the Negev of the Kenites. And David would leave neither man nor woman alive to bring news to Gath, thinking lest they should tell about us and say, so David has done. Such was his custom all the while he lived in the country of the Philistines. And Achish trusted David, thinking he has made himself an utter stench to his people Israel. Therefore he shall always be my servant. And of course, the question here, is he lying? Is he deceiving? Is this something you can do during a time of war? Is it okay to deceive an enemy of Israel? Has he made him his friend? What's going on here? And there's a lot of question to that. But simple thing here is he's just concealing his loyalties. He's concealing what he's actually doing from this enemy of Israel. In chapter 28, in those days, the Philistines gathered their forces to war to fight against Israel. And Achish said to David, understand that you and your men are to go out with me in the army. David said to Achish, very well, you shall know what your servant can do. And Achish said to David, very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life. I mean, there's trust here by this king. Nothing indicating to him that David is his enemy. Or David is a threat to his efforts. So he's won over this guy's trust. And this is a Philistine king. He doesn't need to win or practice by Geneva Convention rules here. He is doing what he can to protect his people, to protect his interests and his loyalties, and to keep himself safe. So this is an interesting time frame in his life here. And commentators would accuse him of sin here. I don't know how you would take that or how it could be explained otherwise. I mean, he's deceiving this king for sure. But people did this at that time, especially slaughtering everybody so that no one would be alive where he would raid to come back and actually be evidence and a witness to what David was doing. So people don't like that idea as well, but that was fairly common in those days. And remember, these are the idolatrous tribes at the time when the Lord told Joshua and Moses to go in and wipe them out. These are part of that. And so they're under the ban. They're under the curse. And so slaughtering such would actually be part of God's purpose, especially the Amalekites. As you see in this later text, the Amalekites are the ones that Saul should have wiped out already, and here they are still alive. And it was due to that that led to Saul's loss of the kingdom. So here he is at this time. He's a warlord here. He's raiding. He's taking this spoil. He's using the spoil now to give to the king of Gath to win his loyalties. And whatever he's doing here, it's effective. It's worked. He's safe. He's protected his people, his own, that he has responsibility over. So concealing those loyalties, here he is in this land. But eventually, the gig is going to be up, right? It's going to implode on him eventually. That's what chapter 29. So jump over to chapter 28. That would be Saul. We'll save that for next time. Chapter 29. Simultaneous to what's going on with Saul, during this year and towards the end of it, year and 4 months, Chapter 29. Now the Philistines had gathered all their forces at Aphek, and the Israelites were encamped by the spring that is in Jezreel. So there's Saul and his encampment, and the Philistines gather. And the Philistines are made up of many kings. Gath would be one of them, Achish there in the city of Gath. And they would come together, the lords of the Philistines, in the spring to fight. As the lords of the Philistines, verse 2, were passing on by hundreds and by thousands, and David and his men were passing on in the rear with Achish, the commanders of the Philistines says, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" Reasonable question. Achish said to the commanders of the Philistines, "Is this not David, servant of Saul, king of Israel, who has been with me now for days and years, and since he deserted to me, I have found no fault in him to this day." Oh, okay, he's a friend. No, verse 4. The commanders of the Philistines were angry with him. The commanders of the Philistines said to him, "Send the man back that he may return to the place to which you have assigned him. He shall not go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he become an adversary to us. For how could this fellow reconcile himself to his Lord? Would it not be with the heads of the men here? Is not this David of whom they sung to one another in dances? Saul has struck down his thousands, and David his 10,000s, and I remind you, those were Philistines that he killed. Then Achish called David and said to him, "As the Lord lives, you have been honest, and to me it seems right that you should march out and in with me in the campaign, for I have found nothing wrong in you from the day of your coming to me to this day. Nevertheless, the Lord's do not approve of you. So go back now. Go peaceably, that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines." So the gig is up, the inevitable hour, I call this. He trusted David, the others didn't, so he can't fight with him. At some point, something had to give in here. At some point, David is going to be revealed. He's not loyal to his enemies, the Philistines. He will be loyal to the people of Israel. At this point, he is marching there, so it's curious, what would he do? What were his intentions eventually? It's not revealed in the narrative. But what the Lord does here, intervening through these kings, prevents David from participating, sends him back to Ziklag. I mean, what would come about if David entered into the battle with Saul? What would that be like? This could have been a real pickle for him and his men. Never a dull moment in the life of David and the choices he's making. Well, let's look ahead here. Verse 8, "And David said to Achish, 'What have I done? What have you found in your servant from the day I entered your service until now, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord the king?' And Achish answered David and said, 'I know that you are blameless in my sight as an angel of God. Nevertheless, the commanders of the Philistines have said, he shall not go up with us to battle. Now then, arise early in the morning with the servants of your Lord who came with you, and start early in the morning and depart as soon as you have light.' So David set out with his men early in the morning to return to the land of the Philistines, but the Philistines went up to Jezreel." So the battle that is being set up there would be the battle that would take Saul's life. and would defeat the Israelites, and David would not be a part of that. David would not have a hand in that. He would be removed from that, and he'd be sent back home and not battle with these that he is aligned with at this point. But chapter 30. Let's walk through this chapter real quick. Here's the shocking calamity. While that is all taking place, he's out with his warriors, his family and whatnot, extended family, and all the family of these soldiers are left at home, and in the meantime, the Amalekites have come and raided Ziklag. Here's what I'll call the shocking calamity. Chapter 30. Now, when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day, the Amalekites had made a raid against the Negev and against Ziklag. They had overcome Ziklag and burned it with fire and taken captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great. They killed no one. That's evidenced by walking into the city and there's no bodies, no slain bodies, no blood. They killed no one. But carried them off and went their way. And when David and his men came to the city, they found it burned with fire, their wives and sons and daughters taken captive. Then David and the people who were with him raised their voices and wept until they had no more strength to weep. David's two wives also had been taken captive, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him because all the people were bitter in soul, each for his sons and daughters. And so here's the calamity, and it's shocking to them. And now they're so grieved and so distressed over this. Here's finally a defeat, if you could say it that way, or a negative thing that happens to David, where there's a loss, there's not a victory here, and they turn on him in their emotion. They're ready to stone the leader of this. You got us into this. You took us up there. We should have stayed here. We could have protected this city, protected our families. But no, this is the result. Here we are. Here's the disaster. Here's the bitter cup that we have to drink. First setback, and they're ready to slay David. That's the suffering of the people. It's all too prone to look to someone to blame, the leader in this case. So that was a shocking calamity. What are they to do? What is there to do? Where do we go? Where are we going to find the raiders who came and took this and took our families? And of course, taking all the children and families, they'd make them their slaves and whatever else, or sell them in slavery or whatever they would do. So they know this would be a terrible outcome. Well, it's time for a search and rescue. And that's the last verses here. And how does David respond? Here is, again, as I gave the title here, Leaning on the Lord. What does David do? How does he respond in such a bitter, distressing situation? Everybody is now turned against him, like children of Israel turned against Moses in the wilderness. Now they're turning against David. You're at fault. You need to do something. Actually, we're going to do something. We'll slay you as a result. We're going to punish you for this result. Someone has to be punished. But David says in verse 6, strengthen himself in the Lord his God. You know who he's leaning on here. He strengthened himself in the Lord his God. This is the mark of what constantly carried David, what constantly was there with his heart and his mind as he's going through the distresses that he was during these years, strengthening himself in his God, trusting in his God, leaning on his God. The leader now sets out with a plan. Leaning on God here, strengthening himself in the Lord, means something. And David now sets a plan, as good leaders will do. Let me give you five things that he does, just five steps of his plan. First thing, consults with his Lord. I need to get an answer. What do I do, God? David said to Abiathar, verse 7, the priest, the son of Ahimelech, bring me the ephod. So Abiathar brought the ephod to David. And David inquired of the Lord, shall I pursue after this band? Shall I overtake them? He, that is God, answered him, pursue, for you shall surely overtake and shall surely rescue. So David set out, and the 600 men who were with him, they came to the brook Besor, where those who were left behind stayed, but David pursued, he and 400 men, 200 stayed behind, who were too exhausted to cross the brook Besor. So consult the Lord, figure out what to do. The Lord gives indication here, pursue. So they go in the direction they think needs to be going. It always starts with seeking the Lord's direction before taking the action. And then they take action. Step number one of his plan. Step two, here's a providential find. They found, verse 11, an Egyptian in the open country. Here's this guy out in the middle of nowhere. What's he doing there? Get him. They brought him to David, and they gave him bread, and he ate. They gave him water to drink, and they gave him a piece of cake of figs and two clusters of raisins. Obviously, he's at the point of, you know, you picture in the desert, here's this person crawling and famished and needing water, and his lips are dried, you know, the old spaghetti western picture type thing. Here's this guy is about to die. Revive him, get him, maybe he has some answers. Maybe he's seen something. And his spirit revived, it says, when he had eaten. For he had not eaten bread or drunk water for 3 days and three nights. And David said to him, "To whom do you belong? And where are you from?" He said, "I am a young man of Egypt, servant to an Amalekite. And my master left me behind because I fell sick 3 days ago. We had made a raid against the Negev of the Cherethites and against that which belongs to Judah and against the Negev of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire." Aha! That's providential. What a find. Verse 15, David said to him, "Will you take me down to this band?" He said, "Swear to me by God that you will not kill me or deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will take you down to this band." I don't want to get in trouble for being the one who tattletales on my master here. Swear by that. And David, sure, just show me where they are. So here's a providential find. We plan our ways. Lord, we want to rescue. What do? Go pursue them. Okay. And the Lord directs his steps right to this young man in the middle of the desert. This is the Lord who's with him. Leaning on the Lord, and the Lord is with him. Third comes the ambush, an Amalekite ambush, verse 16. When he had taken him down, behold, they were spread abroad all over the land. I could see the raiders eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. And David struck them down from twilight until the evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped except 400 young men who mounted camels and fled. And David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken, and David rescued his two wives. Nothing was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything that had been taken. David brought back all. David also captured all the flocks and herds, and the people drove the livestock before him and said, "This is David's spoil." I mean, that's what you call search and rescue. Amazing recovery. Everything is the emphasis here. Clearly, the hand of the Lord is with him, helping him, guiding him, and enabling him at this point. 400 men. We don't know how many Amalekites. 1,000 or so, because 400 young guys are escaping. The rest he defeated. And amazing. Once again, God's protection, support, and presence with David on display here. And then we see a God-centered policy. Watch what he does here. Remember the 200 that got left behind? They're too tired. They're worn out. They'd already been traveling 3 days to get back to Ziklag. And here they're chasing down the Amalekites in the hot desert area. They're worn out. They would be no good in a battle. They're left behind back at Besor. Then David came, verse 21, to the 200 men who had been too exhausted to follow David and who had been left at the brook Besor, and they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. Watch this. And when David came near to the people, he greeted them. Then all the wicked and worthless fellows, there's a few of them in his band. Remember, there's a bunch of odd folks who joined with David because they had trouble with Saul's kingdom. You recall that. The wicked and worthless fellows among the men who had gone with David said, because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered. They don't deserve this. They didn't work for this. They didn't risk their lives for this, except that each man may lead away his wife and children and depart. We'll give them their family, but we get the spoil. And there's greed speaking there from these wicked and worthless fellows. But David will have none of that. He will make a policy here. And watch this in verse 23. And David said, you shall not do so, my brothers, with what the Lord has given us. He has preserved us and given into our hand the band that came against us. Who would listen to you in this matter? For as his share is who goes down into the battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage. They shall share alike. And he made it a statute and a rule for Israel from that day forward to this day. So this is a leader setting up the leadership, and here's a policy pointing back to what? What is the basis of the policy? The Lord is the one who delivered them into our hands. Who are we to take claim on this and say this is our spoil? The Lord gave this to us. He guided us that we might come upon them, and he gave them into our hands. So we're not going to play the greedy ones here. We're going to share alike with all those who are part of us. Not just the warriors, but the ones who are watching the baggage. As a matter of fact, watch what he does now. There's a diplomacy now in verse 26. Diplomatic generosity. And when David came to Ziklag, he sent part of the spoil to his friends, the elders of Judah, saying, here is a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord. So here's a generosity. So he's using this as an opportunity to really win over the favor of his, those who would be loyal to him, his friends, and to show that he's not going to be like those other kings, those other rulers, those other warlords. No, here's the spoil of the Lord. It was for those, he says in verse 27, in Bethel, in Ramoth of the Negev, in the Jatir, in Aror, in Sifmoth, in Eshtemoah, in Rakal, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing these all right, in the cities of the Jerahmeelites, in the cities of the Kenites, in Hormath, in Bor Ashan, in Athak, in Hebron, for all the places where David and his men had roamed. So David had spent time in this area here, and it was just kind of naming all these places in which he's traveling about and hiding from Saul. They'd become loyal to him. They'd become friendly to him. He saw their friendship as important, and so he takes the spoil and shares the wealth with them. And this is diplomatic. This is wise. This is a leader. They share in the spoils of the enemies of the Lord. He has the nation now on his mind, not his own personal promotion, and now the nation has good reason to follow him. So this is kind of, in the meantime, as he's doing these wise things, I don't think he's looking ahead per se and thinking, I need to do this in order to gather the whole nation to my side. He's doing this out of generosity, but it does result in the nation then unifying under his kingdom once Saul is out of the way and taken away by God in the next chapter. So search and rescue used to the benefit of the kingdom in the end. This is kind of a story that's made for TV, isn't it? I mean, can you imagine? This would be a good movie to make. Why not? Let's get David, another David movie, and pick who would be a good actor to play David. You pick the guy. And get a number of people. This would be great stuff. Spaghetti Westerns written all over this thing right here. The hero comes to save the day, rescue the maidens in distress, right? And gets the spoil and then shares it with all the folks back home and everybody's happy. They ride off in the sunset. But really, this is about one thing. The one who leans on the Lord will find strength in the Lord and help in time of need. Lean not on your own understandings, but trust in him, and that's where your strength will be. That's where the Lord will carry you. And it always be living in the lap of comfort. This is David, who really doesn't have a home yet. This is David in the wilderness for many years. David, who's just recently in a despondent moment where he's fearful for his life and for his people, burdened. But he trusts in God and he leans on God and he does the right thing, the diplomatic thing, the gracious thing, the generous thing, the God-centered thing. He's not falling into the trap of sin. And maybe in the midst of danger from all sides, but the Lord will not abandon his people. This is what David knows and learns. His life is a living testimony of the Lord being found trustworthy to lean on and depend on. And if I serve him in whatever the circumstances are, whatever the situation is, the Lord uses those things and those moments to groom us for further things, further ministry. And the further ministry for David, he's going to rule this nation. He's going to be king now, soon. And he's going to bring them all of the tribes together under his rule. It's going to take a work of a leader at this point. Trusts in God and leans on God to see that happen without having a civil war break out, which there was those leanings when his leadership came in. But eventually he would bring it all together by the hand of God. So great scene here at this time. We're going to have to end it here, and next time back up to chapter 28, because we got to take a look at Saul and the demise of that man and his kingdom at the end, and we'll do that next time. All right, let's pray. Lord, I do thank you for this opportunity to walk through the narrative of your word and to see the life of these people who leaned on you, who trusted in you, and see the challenges they faced, the calamities they endured, the relationships that were complex, the choices that they'd have to make, made in faith, sometimes made not in faith. Lord, we learn from these things because you've given them to us in your word that we might know them as examples for us to learn how to be faithful in our context, in our life. We're thankful for the life of David. We're thankful for your faithfulness in his life. And may we learn more and bring application to our lives this week. We don't know what challenges we will face. We don't know what calamities may be around the corner, what trials, what difficulties, what temptations, what may feel like in to David a time of exile, a time of difficulty, a time where we're surrounded by our enemies, and yet there you are with us. May we learn that lesson from this text. May we learn it in our experience, and may your name be honored and glorified in our life. We do thank you for today and this day as it comes to a close, and the week that begins in the workplace or in travel or wherever it is we are taken. We know you will be with us there. You are already out in front of us. And may we acknowledge you and continue to follow you and continue to be faithful as we serve you, knowing your eyes are upon us in everything we do. May we do so in a way that reflects that. As we pray these things in Christ's name, amen.